Take a network break. Secure your virtual donuts from insider exfiltration with our new cloud service called Hey, That's Mine. And join us for our weekly waltz through the latest tech news. And be sure to stay tuned after the news. We've got a sponsored Tech Byte interview with SWIMED. They are a Silver Peak SD-WAN customer. They make a portable telemedicine backpack for emergency first responders. And this was a really cool conversation because they can actually take this backpack out into the field and use it to get telemedicine access to like clinics and hospitals so that first responders can talk to doctors or nurses or whatever out in the field. And they're actually telling us real stories about how this product has saved lives. It's SD-WAN saving lives, sort of. But it's a pretty cool story. So stay tuned after the news to hear more about that. All right, let's get going. Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, has publicly called on Bloomberg to retract its story about malicious chips implanted in Supermicro motherboards.
This story really is taking on life of its own.
And probably not in the way that Bloomberg hoped.
No. Well, they've continued to double down, though. So they've continued to say, we've got evidence and we claim it's right and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And yet nobody's sticking up for Bloomberg. Nobody in the media, various of the various other press outlets, they're like The Guardian, the BBC, Washington Post, New York Times, have all published articles saying that there's no way that what Bloomberg wrote in the article is true or can be substantiated or can be proven or can even be accurate, right? I think this time around, what we've actually seen is that publicly, the Apple CEO, Tim Cook, is actually calling for them to retract in an article at BuzzFeed, right? Oh, okay, so BuzzFeed isn't necessarily a professional media outlet, but right about now, it's certainly more trustable than Bloomberg.
That's right. And here's what Tim Cook said, quote, there is no truth in their story about Apple. They need to do the right thing and retract it. And I, frankly, for the CEO of one of the most profitable public corporations in the world to sort of essentially put his credibility on the line and say, this isn't true, you have to take it down, is quite a statement.
Yes. And Apple has integrity around this. So this isn't, you know, the CEO of a company that normally just lies through his teeth or, you know, makes outrageous statements to get...
It's not Equifax, which we'll talk about later.
No, this Apple is very measured and very has a long established record of saying exactly what they mean. And if they've got any potential for misinterpretation by the market or the audience, they say nothing, which is why often they say nothing, right?
Right.
So for Tim Cook to come out explicitly and say, there's no truth and they need to do the right thing and track it. Now, just to add insult to injury here, Andy Jassy, who's the CEO of AWS, right? Amazon AWS, which is should be very well known to all of us. They were also included because they apparently bought the company Elemental, which had compromised Supermicro motherboards that were specifically called out by Bloomberg. And he actually tweeted, not didn't issue a press release, so, you know, make of that what you will.
Yes.
And I'll quote his tweet and you can find a link in the show notes. The Bloomberg story is wrong about Amazon too. This is in response to Tim Cook's tweet. They offered no proof. The story kept changing and showed no interest in our answers unless we could validate their theories. And this is the kicker right here. Pay attention here. The reporters got played or took liberties. Bloomberg should retract. I absolutely agree with my personal pet theory is that the reporters got played by a state agency, like a security agency. Now, whether it was the US or the Russians, or the Chinese, or, you know, even a criminal gang just wanted to do some stuff, right? But they got played. The reporter really didn't do enough due diligence. They just wanted to believe that this was true and kept researching and asking until they got enough evidence to support their story. And I do feel like they're presenting this to their own bosses and saying, look, this is all the evidence for it. And the bosses are going, oh, well, you know what you're talking about. We'll go with it, right? And I suspect that they've actually spent 2 years building up a story that's not based in fact, but they've got supporting evidence that says what they want it to say.
Right. And I feel like the onus is now on Bloomberg to, if they can, come forward with the actual proof that they're basing their story around. They quoted a lot of unnamed sources in the article, like 17 or 18. And we've also seen folks that they have quoted by name sort of not necessarily walk back, but say, well, maybe they misunderstood or they didn't quite take my comments in the correct context. So yeah, Bloomberg has some work to do here on this story.
Yeah. There's an article at a website surprisingly called Serve the Home, which is actually been posting a bunch of
if it's for home audience, it's a very sophisticated home audience. This is a technically astute publication.
Yeah, they've been publishing some quite hard-hitting security articles for a couple of years now. So I think they've got a writer over there that talks about it in lots of different ways. But they actually do a line-by-line debunking of the entire Bloomberg articles, all of them. And it's quite a substantial piece, actually. It's like several pages long.
It's at least 5 pages long on the web, yeah. And there's a lot of detail, a lot of documentation. I think the writer's name is Patrick Kennedy. I will have a link in the show notes. But yeah, take a look. They really break down the story piece by piece.
Yeah, I get the feeling that the journalist is hiding behind a, we've got secret information from sources and we can't share our sources, so there. And in the meantime, he's handing off with a nice bonus for getting page views, and that makes me suspect until we can see anything more. It's bunk.
All right, we'll keep an eye on this story if it develops, but we'll have time to move on. Arista Networks, they've announced two brand new 400 gigabit Ethernet switches. It's based on the Broadcom Tomahawk 3 chipset. The two switch models are each one rack unit, and they're rack mountable. You get 32 ports of 400 gig.
Yeah, now, I think there's an interesting thing here in that Arista's a little bit late to the market here. We've seen 400 gig switches announced by most other vendors. Arista's coming to the market. And now, at the same time, Cisco hasn't announced anything in the 400 gig space that I've noticed. Have you?
I think we did actually talk about a Cisco 400 gig that they're sort of trialing and testing. I'll have to look at our old show notes, but I do feel like they did say something about 400 gig.
Okay.
A Nexus switch, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe I've missed it and there's something out there, but this, of course, is based on the Broadcom Tomahawk 3 Ethernet switch. The Tomahawk 3 has got 256 SerDeses, each at 50 gigs. So you can actually bind those 256 50 gig interfaces into whatever output you want. And that means that you could have, you know, 32 ports of 400 gig in a single switch if you're not using breakout cables. So I think the big thing that Arista might have done here is actually spent their time focusing on software features around large flows and buffer management, which actually sets them apart from a lot of other people, I think.
Yeah, they made a note of talking about how they have this new feature called elephant flow detection and deprioritization. So if there are elephant and mice flows floating through your network, they can detect those elephant flows and deprioritize them so that the mice flows or the bursty traffic doesn't get clogged up behind these bigger flows.
Which is increasingly important as you get into bigger networks. This is not an enterprise product, I don't believe. I think this is very much targeted at cloud providers.
No, very much for hyperscale. Yeah, they're pointing this directly at the cloud customer.
So you won't see things here that you are necessarily going to buy, but those people who are doing very large IP storage networks, they have very large data flows. So if you're shunting around 500 terabyte data files, you can actually saturate 400 gig uplinks. I'm actually wrestling with a network that's slightly scaled down, but they have 25 gig connected servers that are flooding 100 gig ECMP spines. Just so much data now coming off the storage arrays when you do them at the right design and the right speed. So this is an issue. So this elephant flow detection and deprioritization is sort of a differentiator, but keep in mind not much else about this which is different other than the fact of Arista software and which features they've chosen to implement from the Tomahawk 3 chipset.
That's right. And also the ship, they're saying that optics is going to take a while to ramp up to catch up with this. So they're not expecting full volume optic availability until the first half of 2019. But the first of these switches will be shipping by the end of this year.
Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about optics in a bit. I was having a look at the OSFP optics that they're talking about for this switch. Obviously, 400 gigs is going to burn an awful lot of power. And it turns out that Arista about 3 years ago kicked off a new standard called OSFP, which is a new optic system for 400 gig. It's interesting because they've got two switches. One uses OSFPs, which is an Arista initiative, and another one uses a QSFP-DD. Now, the reason for this is that when you're in a 19-inch rack format, you can't just keep making them bigger, and nobody wants to do a 2RU switch, and everybody wants to stay in the same form factor. So what you're trying to achieve is to keep everything inside of a 19-inch wide 1RU-sized faceplate. And that, of course, is actually quite difficult. And at 400 gig, you're actually burning a lot of power. Now,
I believe it's actually 5 watts per 100 gig. So if you quadruple that, it's 20 watts.
Yeah. And just distributing that, got two problems there. One is getting all the components into the size of the, you know, because what you're actually talking about here is like in the active coax, you've actually got 16 copper pairs. So you're actually splitting that signal into 25 gig over 16 pairs. If you're doing it in a fiber optic cable, you can be using an MPO8 pair. Or you can actually run it into an LC where you actually got an eight-way DWDM in the head end, all right? So, and there's also another one which I thought was quite interesting. There's a thing called a CS, which is a four-core, so two-pair solution as well. So there's a whole range of different interfaces available here. I don't know which ones will win over time, but the idea of plugging an MPO8 pair in with 16 fiber cores as a patch lead, I suspect most people will use active optical cables here to do this. You're not likely to buy the laser transmitters versions. They're just too expensive. It makes most sense in a data center. But the challenge there, of course, is everything has to be within the distance of the active optical. So 5 meters, 10 meters, 40 meters, maybe. So these are really extraordinary devices. And the OSFP was led by Arista. And I think the QSFP was a consortium led by Cisco. So there's an interesting sort of Arista versus Cisco thing going on here.
Back to that.
yeah, it is interesting. There's a blog post on Cisco which talks about the 400 gig QSFP DD standard. So I would suggest that when I went to look at the OSFP, I noted that the consortium did not have Cisco listed as a participant. So it looks like Cisco has bets on the bidirectional DD standard for 4 gig. I'll put the link in the show notes for that as well. And you can understand that it looks like the market is attempting to diversify away one way or the other.
All right, well, moving on, we mentioned Equifax earlier, and you'll recall that they had a breach that exposed the personal and financial information of 143 million consumers. Now an engineer who helped set up the company's breach notification website has been sentenced for insider trading.
Yeah, insider threats are actually probably, in my experience, the most substantial threat. They're far more significant than external threats. Even though we spend a lot of time configuring firewalls and all that sort of stuff, really, insider threats are far worse. And in this case, apparently this engineer was actually working on the website that was actually to apologize to customers where they could come and check on it.
Yep.
And when he realized what he was doing, he got onto his wife's trading account and started putting in some bets that the stock would drop.
Yeah, I think he was essentially short-selling his own stock, yeah.
Short-selling his own company.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the whole, not a bad risk. I mean, he made 75 grand, and now he has to pay a 50 grand fine, has to return the 75 grand, pay a 50 grand fine, and get 8 months of home confinement. That's pretty good odds, and a bit not, you know.
I take your point exactly. It was pretty good odds that he might have gotten away with it. And this, you know, obviously a $50,000 fine is nothing to sneeze at, but he's not going to jail. That's crazy.
No, yeah. Insider trading is insider trading. I mean, those are good odds. If he had gotten away with it, you know, I like them odds. Keep in mind, too, that most of the other people involved in the Equifax breach who were actually Equifax employees, quite a few of them actually walked away with handsome handshakes. Like the CISO and the CIO both got bonuses for retirement. They got retired immediately in the follow-up and got handsome payouts to be the four, you know.
The golden parachute, yeah.
That's a good deal too.
It's very frustrating that a clear case of insider trading and essentially a slap on the wrist. It's very frustrating. Should also note the SEC is investigating a fellow named Jun Ying, who was a high-ranking Equifax executive. He is also accused of sold off apparently all his available stock options ahead of the breach announcement because he had insider knowledge. The SEC is still investigating his case, so we'll see if he can, if he has to stay home for 8 months, which doesn't sound bad to me.
I suspect he'll get a bit more because he's actually an executive and he might be, this guy's just an insider who got some wind of it.
Just an engineer.
Just an engineer. But when you're an executive with, you know, if you're on the board or something like that, privy, then the SEC gets after you a little bit harder. I suspect he'll be getting a lot more than a slap on the wrist like that.
Could be. All right, tech website The Information is citing unnamed sources to say that Facebook may be looking to acquire a cybersecurity company, perhaps to help improve its reputation for protecting user data, which is not a good reputation.
Not really. Facebook continues to suffer from a backlash against everything it's done. And this makes no sense whatsoever. Facebook doesn't need...
Zero sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense to me at all. Facebook doesn't need a firewall company to run its internal systems. I might want a threat intelligence company to feed into their data set so that they can find and analyze new threats. And it maybe instead of buying a feed or renting the data by, you know, from various companies, you know, there are many companies out there that do threat intelligence. They actually want to buy one of those. So if the writers here don't understand the difference between a threat intelligence as a firewall or cybersecurity, as opposed to cybersecurity as a firewall or other things, then that makes more sense. But if I did want to be much more like, you know, conspiratorial or in Facebook's face, it's possible that they're thinking about building a home product to put on to put a firewall in the home. And the reason they would do that is to capture all the data that you surf the internet for so that they can then provide you with better ads.
So my first impression was that this smacks of security theater, that Facebook is essentially buying a security company just to say, hey, look, we're taking security seriously and we take it so seriously. We just dropped, you know, whatever, $250 million on a security company. But it's not actually going to do anything to protect them that you could just do by buying security products or using security products regularly. You don't have to own the company to improve your own security. If your notion is correct that they're actually going to be rolling out a home security product, boy, that's real stones to be a company based around profiting off your users and mining them, surveilling them.
If you're a surveillance company,
then you're going to sell them a security product when you can't even protect the information you've already got. That is wow.
Yeah. If your business is personal surveillance, well, what you want is more data about surveilling people. And if they can get a hold of your home gateway, they can really get up there, right? And they can match your Facebook logins. Imagine if they could have the router in your home.
Yeah. Oh, I can see why they would definitely want to have that product. And the more you talk about it, the more I think.
They've already got the Facebook portal, which they announced a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, like one of those home assistants.
Yeah, well, it's not really. It was just meant to be a video conferencing system, but they want you to put it in the kitchen, but it doesn't do anything but video conference with another Facebook portal. So kind of dumb. Like, who wants to go into the kitchen to make a telephone call? You know, to see you, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I can't imagine that anyone would buy a security product from Facebook, but what do I know? But that just stuns me if that's the idea. Stuns
me. Well, I'm sure there's lots of people out there who use Facebook who don't even know all the things that we're concerned about and that we bang on about. I've spoken to people and they go like, what? Facebook's fine. I love it. I use it all the time. Blah, blah, blah. You come talk to real people. That's what they'll tell you. Yeah. Obviously it is because you've seen how much money Facebook is making.
Good point.
Yeah. So somebody's using it. Yeah.
Good point. All right. A quick break to just let listeners know that the videos we put up from this month's virtual design clinic, they're now available at our membership site. That's ignition.packetpushers.net. If you're already a member, the videos are available in the free tier. So you can just go and start watching. If you're curious about these videos, you can sign up for free. Check them out. The videos, they included a variety of Ask Me Anything sessions. We had a panel of experts who answered networking and design questions from the audience. And there's three technical presentations, including using Puppet for network automation, an introduction to Terraform, and understanding switch ASICs. That was a really good one.
Yeah, that one was popular.
Yeah.
That was done by Pete Lumbus, who does work, has a job, day job, doing just that, white box switches. And he was explaining the differences between them and got a lot of positive feedback about that one that I personally heard of. The other ones too, quite well received. But that one particularly, I've heard people saying good things.
That's right. So it's from our recent virtual design clinic and all the videos are available for free on ignition.packetpushers.net. And we're going to be holding our third virtual design clinic on December 19th. So you can mark your calendars. That's also a free event. Registration's open at packetpushers.net/VDC. Okay, moving on. Facebook isn't the only one talking about buying security companies. Fortinet and Checkpoint have recently announced acquisitions to bolster their own portfolios. Fortinet's buying ZoneFox for an undisclosed amount. If you hadn't heard of them, they hunt for insider threats by tracking user behavior and then looking for anomalies. They have agents that run on end-user devices, and they send that data to the cloud for analytics.
Yeah, so both of these acquisitions are about insider threats to a greater or lesser degree. Fortinet, the ZoneFox acquisition is particularly threat detection and automated response capabilities against insider threats. Yeah. So that is your employees.
That's right.
And indeed, Dome 9 is identical. It acquires that as the same thing. So you might be detecting a trend there. Neither of these companies are particularly large. So they're startups selling out early in the cycle. I think both companies declared neither of these as material to their results. So that sort of suggests they're less than $10 or $20 million worth of revenue.
Small buys.
Yeah, basically buying a feature. These were probably never products in their own right. And like many startups, they'll develop a feature which will then be acquired by a company to be, you know, belted into an existing product. So the unique thing about this is there's threat detection capabilities. So the companies have either built a threat intelligence engine or they've worked out a way to take feeds from third parties and turn that into a product. And then the other part is that they're actually doing automated response. So they'll go into the cloud, look at the configuration of AWS or Azure or perhaps GCP. I don't know which ones they particularly support or not.
And this is Dome 9 you're talking about, which is the company Checkpoint bought.
Both of them, I think. My understanding is that ZoneFox is pretty similar.
ZoneFox looks like it's built its own cloud service and it takes data from an agent on user devices. Dome 9 is looking at your public cloud deployments on AWS, Azure, and Google.
So basically rounding out the security portfolio. In other words, companies like Checkpoint and Fortinet don't actually do innovation internally. They buy it in and then tell everybody they've got innovation, but conveniently forgetting to say that somebody else built it and they just bought it.
That's right. Yeah. And I should note that Dome 9, what they're talking about is making sure that all of your policies and security controls in the cloud are actually doing what you intended them to do, or in fact, are they even there? We've definitely seen companies sort of shoot themselves in the foot by having like openly public S3 buckets and so on. So they're also touting governance and compliance, which I think is that magic word that gets CIOs and CISOs to start signing those checks.
Yeah, keep in mind, one thing I noticed too is that Dome 9 is actually focused in Tel Aviv in Israel, and Checkpoint is also headquartered in Israel, is an Israeli listed on the US Stock Exchange. So they're very much keeping it at home. I often find Israeli companies don't do very well spreading their tentacles around the world. They like to keep it all in the family, if you like. So that would certainly have made Dome 9 attractive to Checkpoint, I think.
Absolutely. All right, staying with Checkpoint, the company also announced its 2018 Q3 results. The top line numbers, the company brought in $471 million for the quarter, which is a 4% jump over last year, and earned $226 million in income.
Yeah, so that's pretty handy. Like, you know, total effort, $471 million. and then almost 50% income.
That's pretty good. I looked at that number and I was like, wow, they are efficient.
Yeah. Well done, Enterprise IT. You half of what you pay for goes straight into the shareholders' pockets at Checkpoint. Fabulous, right? What could go wrong, right? The other thing I know, it just struck me as I was looking at this, is just how small Checkpoint really is. Like 50% net profit margin is astounding in its own right, but they're only $471 million. So that's less than $2 billion a year. I mean, F5 Systems does $2 billion a year in revenue and is bigger than Checkpoint, which is kind of not what I expected when I sort of noticed this.
Yeah, me too, because Checkpoint has also been around for a really long time. They've got definitely a long tail in the enterprise market. I would expect them to be a little bit bigger.
Yeah, and they ain't. But when you make a 50% gross margin, pretty hard to go and grow because as your margin shrinks, so does your share price, right?
Yeah.
So having very high profit margins like this can be a curse unless you've got a really good executive team that convinced the market that you can execute. And I don't think Checkpoint's really got that. In fact, their share price fell after this announcement because people don't think that the growth is sustainable.
Hmm. Yeah, that's how the street is.
Sucks to be them.
All right, Juniper Networks is also reporting quarterly numbers. They posted revenues of $1.17 billion, but that is down 6% year over year and down 2% from last quarter. On the bright side, they had net income of $223 million, which was up 35% year over year. So a little good news, a little bad news.
Yeah, so the Juniper results like this was the market did various things, but generally I think they beat them down.
I'll say that the company cited enterprise and service provider areas as strengths, which were offset by weakness in their cloud customers.
Yeah, so the market took the results pretty well. The share prices worked out roughly about even, holding steady between $27 and $28, so neither up or down. So that means that the market believes what Rami Rahim is telling them. One way or the other. So there was a couple of things when they had a telephone call with analysts. So I checked the transcript. Rami said, we reported better than Q3 results as continued enterprise strength and better than expected service provider results more than offset weakness in the cloud. So we've talked before about there being three markets in the four networking vendors now. There's the enterprise, service provider, and the cloud. The cloud is turning away from the traditional vendors as a general trend. And then in answer to a question, they said, why are you not able to get back into the cloud? And he said, I want to emphasize the fact that timing of projects within the major cloud provider is really tied to a very few number of customers. And so if you get the predictions wrong for just those customers, then obviously that puts challenges up. So what they're saying there is, you know, if one of the big cloud providers decides not to place an order in this quarter, then your results get all screwy.
Yeah.
When you're a relatively small company, which Juniper is, you can't sort of fix the books to tell what you want us to do like Cisco does.
Right, you can't smooth it out, yeah.
Yeah, Cisco's very good at some creative accounting to flatten out its results and say what it wants them to say. It's very predictable about its results, and it has different people in the financial community have different theories about why Cisco's results are just so predictable, but yeah. But he did actually specifically call out, he said, I'm very honestly pleased with our performance in the enterprise space all up and in security. There is definitely a robust spending environment in the enterprise globally that we're taking advantage of. But we're now seeing 7 consecutive quarters of year-over-year growth in the enterprise, and the last quarter in Q3, 15% year-over-year. So Juniper's turnaround to approach the enterprise seems to be having traction, although the enterprise seems to be spending now that they sort of understand cloud and, you know, the first hubbub around cloud is, and the enterprises are sort of holding back, I think, generally. They're testing the cloud, but they're not using it. Juniper's getting some nice sales out of that. So maybe this is a signal that Cisco's result will be pretty good when they come out in a few weeks.
Yeah, that could be. I think it's interesting that a lot of these traditional IT vendors who turn to the cloud in hopes of grand fortunes have gotten a little bit burned. Juniper is one. I remember we talked about HPE, Meg Whitman talking about how one or two customers essentially could really destroy their quarterly earnings. And so they're sort of just trying to walk back from that and again, refocus on the enterprise.
Yeah, that's what we've been talking about here. But it's also, they would have had no way of predicting that these companies could turn to white box so quickly
and doing
their own manufacturing, their own product development, their own, you know, the idea that these companies are now outspending any of the traditional IT vendors for in-house product development and investment in R&D is really something that would have been very difficult to comprehend, say, 5 years ago. So it's hard to blame them for not chasing after the cloud. And
sure.
Of course, the cloud companies went, well, okay, if you're going to help me get my business off the ground, I'll take it. But, you know, in the meantime, use that launch to be able to basically walk away from the companies that helped them, which is, you know, how business goes.
That's right. There's no friends. All right, we've got some other earnings to get through before we wrap up the show. Microsoft, they took in $29.1 billion in revenue for the first quarter of fiscal 2019. That's up 19% year over year. And they also pulled in net income of $8.8 billion, up 34%. Their Azure revenues are also up 76% year over year, although that growth is slowing on a quarter by quarter basis because last quarter the company reported 89% growth. But wow, 76% is pretty dang good.
At that sort of growth, 80 to 90%, if you're working inside of Azure, you'd have one person sitting next to you, and the next week there'd be, you know,
10.
another one. Yeah. That's a lot of growth, obviously, and clouds are, you know, the hot thing. And what's probably the most key thing here is that if you read the articles going around in the press is that Microsoft has now got a larger market cap than Amazon, which is not a narrative that anybody saw coming. If you know what I mean.
Right.
Remember a few weeks ago, there was like, who will be the first $1 trillion company? Will it be Amazon or will it be Apple? And now all of a sudden, Microsoft is on path to actually get there second. So we'll see. I don't really care one way or the other. It's something that people who, you know, executives who count their success in terms of dollars, that's the sort of thing they care about. But it is a substantial turnaround for a company that was really seen to be in terminal decline when Ballmer was forced out. Remember, it's only a few years since Bill Gates left, and then Ballmer was actually forced out. He didn't want to go. They carried him out kicking and screaming in a pine box and then put in a new CEO over his sort of dead body, nearly dead body. It's going to be interesting. Now, Microsoft there was a sell-off following these announcements because of the growth reduction. People weren't expecting him to say the cloud is slowing down. Interestingly, when we'll talk about Amazon results, you'll also see the same story down there.
That's right. All right, so let's get to that. Amazon also reported Q3 financials. The retail and cloud giant had revenues of $56.6 billion. AWS was $6.7 billion of that $56 billion, and that is up 46%, an operating profit of $2.1 billion just from AWS alone, 77% growth.
Yeah, astonishing. $2.1 billion operating profit, right?
Yeah, that's profit. wasn't revenue.
So again, yeah.
And that's just AWS, not the rest of the business, yeah.
Yeah, 30% of what you give to AWS goes straight into the pot as profit. So if you're not sure that you're overpaying, no doubt about it, right? Which is extraordinary.
Yes.
Yeah, sugar water has got nothing on clouds.
That's right.
However, as you say, the stock price dropped almost 10% because the growth won't hit the expectations that was previously. The cloud was sort of seemed to be an infinitely growing, and you know, obviously that was never going to be true. But also, just to give you some perspective, let's compare AWS's revenue to Cisco. Cisco earns about $12.6 billion a quarter. AWS is doing 6.7. So Amazon gross revenue is slightly more than half of Cisco today, which is quite astonishing.
It is.
And HPE earns $7.5 billion a quarter. So Amazon AWS is now approaching HPE's size and scale, which is just an astonishing considering that it's barely 10 years old.
That's right. If you spun off AWS, it would probably be one of the leading tech companies in the country on the market by revenue. Yeah.
Yes. And that is actually possible. There is a significant political will to start thinking about breaking up Microsoft and Amazon and Apple and Facebook and those types of things because they're too big. When they get more powerful than the government of the country that they're in, it's probably time to break them up, but who knows what that we'll see what happens with that over time. This isn't the forum to discuss that, but it is really quite extraordinary. So that's why Amazon stock fell 9% because AWS is seen as the business that pays for everything else that Amazon's doing. So it'll be interesting to see how they come around that. That's partly why Azure is more valuable than Amazon because the stock fell so hard.
It could be. I mean, the thing with Amazon is that you've got the AWS business, but it's also still essentially a retail company. And the company said, Amazon said, we're not expecting to grow as much in Q4, despite the retail bonanza of the holidays that Wall Street was expecting. So they got dinged for that. So there's that mix of tech business and traditional retail that can harm or help Amazon's results. And Microsoft doesn't have to worry about that. It's all about business.
That's right.
Well, that wraps up this week's news. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
Well, before we rush into this interview with Silver Peak, which is really, really interesting, I just wanted to flag that I'm doing a lot of YouTube lately. So if you haven't checked out the YouTube channel that the Packet Pushers have put together, I'm really, really hoping to get an interview. I went to somebody's data center and did a tour, and I'm really proud of it. So hopefully by the time you hear the show, it will be published and you should get over there and check that out because I think it's pretty, pretty interesting.
You're just waiting on approval to post that video from the data center organization.
Indeed.
Okay. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
All right. Well, stay tuned for that Silver Peak Tech Bites. You're going to hear from their customer, SWIMED, talking about their telemedicine system for first responders. And that's coming right up. Welcome to Tech Bites, a short, sharp, sponsored conversation to get you up to speed on new ideas and technologies. Our sponsor today is Silver Peak, and they've sent over a customer for us to chat with. We're joined by Jeff Erdan. He is Chief Operating Officer of SWIMED, and they make telemedicine solutions. Jeff, welcome to Tech Bytes, and start us off with a quick introduction to SWIMED and what the company does.
Absolutely. Well, thank you guys for having me. SWIMED is a telemedicine solution primarily for first responders, remote clinics, places that you thought of not really being able to deliver medicine in the past. We've got software and hardware solutions that allow live streaming of video from wherever the patient happens to be, whether that's the side of a mountain or scene of an accident, back to a major medical center, back to consulting physicians, and allows you to get the best eyes on the patient as quickly as possible.
So the idea is if first responders are out at a site, they can essentially dial back and get video and audio to a clinic, to doctors or physicians or people who may be more expert to provide some immediate advice or care. But for a patient who's actually could be hundreds, thousands of miles away?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's cool. And you've, SWIMED has developed actually like a portable telemedicine backpack.
Yeah. So one of the things that we found is we created this software that was very good about managing bandwidth. That's really kind of the special sauce. And people said, oh, that's so cool. Let's try it past the end of the driveway. Well, when you get off the network, the software can do only so much. And then all of a sudden you've got a connectivity problem. And so the backpack responds to that. We put together enterprise grade modems, antennas, and of course the Silver Peak unit to sort of manage all that in order to take our software and be able to take it further away from the hardwired networks that everybody's used to working on.
Now, you mentioned modems and so on. So is that 3G, 4G, LTE kind of modems?
It is. And then, of course, in the future, it'll be 5G and 6G and 25G.
So then where does the Silver Peak solution come into the backpack?
So one of the things that is interesting about cellular is that while it's great, it also can have a certain level of inconsistency or unreliability based on silly things, right? You're driving down the highway and a truck passes you, that cuts off your line of sight and puts a huge chunk of metal between you and the tower, and your call drops. And so one of the things when you're talking about an emergency situation where you've got to stay connected, we decided we needed to be able to have multiple carriers at the same time. But switching from carrier to carrier, even with a high quality modem, you miss a beat. And so what the Silver Peak allows us to do is put a software layer on top of that modem connection and elegantly, seamlessly, sub-second switch from carrier to carrier so that the application doesn't even know it's switched. It's just communicating with the operating system, and it's all magically getting to the server in the cloud.
Okay, so that's essentially what an SD-WAN device is supposed to do. And usually, Ethan, when we've been talking to folks about SD-WAN, it's more of a branch or a remote office solution. But Silver Peak actually apparently has an appliance that SWIMED has actually fit into the backpack that goes along with a laptop and a camera and so on. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things, as exactly as you're saying, I think we are probably the first known application of SD-WAN going into the mobile space, which kind of opens up a whole new area of interest because you can start to think about pipeline workers and nuclear weapons inspectors and forward operating military groups that have the need for potentially multiple connections, some of the path smoothing stuff that Silver Peak can do, all manner of people, and the switching, whether it's cellular or satellite or other types of networks that can all be connected into SD-WAN. But you need someone who's got the technical capability, which Silver Peak does, to bring it all together and to make it usable from the solution provider's perspective.
Now, did you have a testing process where before you kind of knew you had this problem, you were trying to shovel video over LTE and had performance or quality problems with the call? Then you did some testing with Silver Peak and it improved. How was that process?
Oh, yeah, we never tested it.
I mean, I know it's an obvious question, right? But I mean, I really want to understand, what was that contrast between the before and after?
No, so you're right. And the interesting thing for us is there were two things that happened kind of at the same time, where we were putting our solution into the back of ambulances so that people could connect potential stroke cases to the emergency room to connect with a neurologist. One was in Richmond, Virginia, and you would think Richmond, Virginia, it's a fairly significant metro area, great cell coverage. And what we discovered was that it's great cell coverage, except where it isn't. And the carrier, who shall remain nameless, did, 90-95%, but had these fairly substantial dead spots. And in those dead spots, there was another carrier, who shall remain nameless, that worked just great. We had the same problem up in eastern Pennsylvania, where the topography was really the issue. You've got a cell tower on one side of a mountain, and you've got someone else's cell tower on the other side. And depending on which side of the mountain you're on, you've got 100% signal from one carrier and 0% from the other. And so again, it cried for a dual carrier solution. And we went through, God almighty, probably 8 or 10 different types of hardware, software, VPN type solutions that all said, oh, we give you easy switching, easy management, insulate you from that kind of carrier switching problem, and just found none of them did it in an acceptable length of time. I think the closest was getting down to about a 6-second drop as you were switching from one to the other. And so finally, we tried the Silver Peak, the Edge Connect appliance, which is just a teeny little box. It's a little bit bigger than a cell phone, and it worked like a charm. It got us down to the kind of switching time that is just sort of normal variation in packet transmission anyway. It became a really invisible process.
So on that switchover, I mean, as in you really can't tell that if you're a person just consuming the video, you're watching the video stream, you can't tell that anything happened.
You can't. Essentially what happens is we have a smooth stream of video, and it can go out over either or both at the same time, or, 2 plus a satellite connection. And when it gets to the data center, it's assembled properly as one stream and is sent on to the far end.
And does the first responder need to have, do they have to do anything? Do you have to train them, or is it all pre-configured? They just open the box and start using it.
That's the great thing about it, is that this is just under the hood. So the backpack, there's an on-off button, and there's a place where you plug it in. And beyond that, they don't need to know what's inside it, and they don't need to know how it works. It just works. So it's been just a tremendous solution.
So you're deploying these backpacks, and the cards to connect to the LTE networks are already in the device. They're just ready to roll.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that we, is part of our setup onboarding kind of process is, as an example, we have a client who's down in the hills of North Carolina, and down there, U.S. Cellular is real strong. We wouldn't normally have thought that that's the right carrier to pick, but these guys knew it, and they said, hey, we want to just be sure U.S. Cellular's in there. And so it was, and, it's, as far as we're concerned, a SIM is a SIM is a SIM. So we're just trying to be responsive to our clients.
Now, you mentioned satellite as well. Are you actually using satellite for some of these video transmissions?
We have done it for going back to the original foundation of the company, our software transport layer was actually written for satellite. It was a European media company that wanted to transmit data from Europe to the Olympic Games in Atlanta. It's sort of interesting because we've been talking about this a lot lately that, we think of ourselves as a video telehealth company, but the truth is that the thing that's special and interesting about us is the ability to transmit data. And that data doesn't have to be video. It can be audio. It can be just files. could be patient streaming data, like from an EKG or from a pulse oximeter, some other medical device, or something that's non-medical, you know, could be a Geiger counter. And so that ability to very efficiently stream data over networks, they're challenging, whether that's a satellite network or a rural network or a network that's urban but very congested. You know, for us, it doesn't matter. It's the ability to efficiently send data and get it from A to B complete in as little time as possible. So you've got low latency and a very spontaneous feel to your interaction.
Can you give us a sense of what the impact has been of this telemedicine backpack and the Edge Connect appliance on the actual first responders or medical teams who are using it out in the field?
Sure. So the best examples, you know, a couple have come out of work we're doing out in West Texas in the oil fields there, where we're working with Texas Tech University and we're wiring up ambulances with our video telehealth solution, and the backpack, the Edge Connect devices are all going out there. And so we had a story not that long ago of a guy who had called EMS. He had chest pain. The EMS crew went out. They met with him, looked at his EKG strip, and they thought he really needed to go to the University Medical Center, but he wanted to stay in his local hospital. And the law in Texas is if the patient says what they want, they're conscious, they can make a decision, that you have to actually, you know, abide by that. So the crew dialed up the hospital where they would have taken him and showed the strip to him. The doctor there talked with the patient and he said, you know what, you could come here, but we don't have the resources to help you. You need to go to the University Medical Center. They called in an airlift ambulance. 5 minutes later, he was at the University Medical Center. About a half an hour later, he was in full cardiac arrest.
Wow.
But he was in the right place. And so they were able to shock him back to regular rhythm. They were able to do an intervention. The next morning, he's up and walking around. 3 days later, he's going home. And if he had gone where he wanted to go, who knows? He may not have ever left the hospital.
So you're saying the doctor at the location he said he wanted to go to said, you can come here, but I recommend you go to a different facility where they can treat you better. And that's what happened. And it sounds like a potentially
life-saving decision. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And we had a somewhat similar case of a auto accident. Again, it's pretty far out in the wilderness. The EMS crew went and picked up a woman who had lost a lot of blood. And the typical solution would be to get her directly to the local level one trauma center. The problem was she had lost so much blood, they thought she was getting a little unstable. And without a medical directive, they can't infuse her, give her additional blood. So they called the medical center, the trauma center where they were going to head, and got the authorization to stop by the local hospital, which was a little bit out of the way, but had the right kind of blood. They picked it up. They set up the infusion, which kept her stable long enough to get her to the trauma center. And so again, you know, there's all these rules that are in place for a good reason, but they sometimes get in the way of the right decision. And so having a system that can communicate from wherever you are to where you need to get to is helping people to make the right decision, get the patient to the right place with the right process, so that you've got the best care.
Yeah, this kind of gives me a whole new perspective on the term mission critical. Unfortunately, this does wrap up our time. I want to thank you, Jeff, for joining us. This was a really cool discussion. If people want to find out more about SWIMED, where should they go?
www.swimed.com. And we've also got a Twitter feed at SWIMED.
And that's SWYMED.
Yes.
Well, that was Jeff Erdan. He is Chief Operating Officer at SWIMED, speaking on behalf of Silver Peak, talking about their telemedicine backpack solution. Thank you, Jeff, for joining us. And thank you all the listeners for joining us for this episode of Tech Bytes. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.